Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's 5 o'clock and it's Wednesday. And if it's 5 o'clock and it's Wednesday and you are lucky enough to be tuning into the Heritage Radio Network, then you are listening to me, Phil Colicchio, bringing you the business of the business live today from beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. We broadcast each week at 5 p.m. on Wednesdays. The business of the business is the show that talks about the business side of the hospitality industry. You know, we like to say that we'd prefer to talk about how much the parsley costs and what it really is meant to do on your plate. But what it's meant to do on your plate also enhances your experience, and it's all part of the business. If you miss this broadcast live, and occasionally I hear once in a while people miss it live, you can go to our website, which is www.heritageradionetwork.org. Click on the business icons, and you can jump right into the business of the business and listen to any one of our past episodes. It's great to say that every week. I'm here today with a very, very busy man, and there's really no time to dilly-dally when you have a busy man in your studio. But today's guest is someone that... that I have a great deal of both admiration and respect for. We're going to talk to a chef today, a chef that that took his life away from what he knew, took it probably 1,000 miles away, staked a claim, and as a result has really developed into not just a brilliant, brilliant chef, but an economic force and a, frankly, an example of the benefits of diversity in terms of how you do your restaurant business. Today, I get to talk with Chef Michael Schwartz, generally known as the James Beard Foundation award-winning chef owner of Michael's Genuine. But to say that he's the owner and chef of Michael's Genuine, you know, is sort of to call Derek Jeter a baseball player. He's a lot more than that. Michael, thank you for getting on a plane, flying up here today, sitting down in our beautiful studio here in Bushwick, and talking with me.
All for this. I don't know what that was or what... I don't know. What was that?
It's an introduction.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
I'm a little teary. Yeah.
You feeling okay?
Yeah, I'm feeling great. You know, and I appreciate that introduction.
What
and
are you doing?
Because, you know, we're great friends.
I think we are.
And I love... You know,
test me,
so,
but I think we
so
are.
So I'd have to say that I owe a lot of my success in business to you.
Who?
So there. You,
wow.
Phil Colicchio.
Well, that's extraordinarily kind of you to say. So what is it you wanted to talk to me about? Michael.
What?
No,
yes.
I know. Sometimes friendship gets in the way of good interviews. So let's put that aside. Thank you for that compliment. I get it's a joy working with you.
No, it happens to be true, though.
Well, thanks.
You know, that transition from being a chef, and that's what I do, and
yeah.
I've been a chef my whole life, that transition from being a chef in a restaurant to, you know, to running business and negotiating business and you know, the... is a tough one. Yeah. So,
yes.
So, yeah. There have been few people along the way that have mentored me and have taught me. And I'm thankful for those people. You're one of them. There were some other ones, but you know that. So that transition is tough, you know. And it's funny now because I feel like I'm in a position now where I could coach and mentor some younger people, and I've been doing that.
I think it's
great. I get great pleasure from that.
And I think that you can. I think, frankly, that that's a natural extension of who you are. And frankly, it's one of the reasons I like doing this broadcast is because it's an extension of my, you know, my professional side. And I get to talk with people like you, people with whom I work, people with whom I admire, get to talk to them about their business and get to talk to them about how they've, you know, how they've succeeded. More importantly, I like talking to them about their failures because, you know, we all learn more from our failures than we do from our successes, right? So, you know, anecdotes like that, even though I know you've not, other than your selection of sports teams that you favor.
You mean the failure when I left the Giants-Eagles game early and didn't get to see the 28 points in 7 minutes? Is that the failure?
That was a pretty big one.
It
was a pretty big one.
Sorry about that.
Not everyone knows what we're talking about. We will get back to that. A little background on you, Michael. You know, people who listen to the show regularly know that I've got a touch of Philadelphia bias. I like to talk about Philadelphia because it's really a laboratory. I like to say it's really Philadelphia is now what Brooklyn was probably 5 years ago in the food scene. So much is happening. You grew up there. You came out of Philadelphia. Did it feed you?
Well, it's interesting because most of what's happened in Philadelphia culinarily and in the restaurant scene happened after I left. You know, so I left quite some time ago. 1986 is when I left Philadelphia. So did it feed me? Yeah, that's where I started my career. I worked a good number of years there in a good restaurant for a good restaurant group, right. And learned a lot. You know, so I guess it was a springboard for me. But like I said, when I left, and really most recently, I think, is when, you know, it took off in terms of exciting restaurants and innovation.
But you stayed connected to your roots there.
I still have family there and friends in the business and love going back and visiting and, you know, and checking out restaurants there, getting inspired. You know, so Philly's in my blood.
So Philly sort of gets you started, but then you go to Miami, which in 1986, 1987, I don't think anybody would call it a culinary capital.
Well, yeah, that's an understatement. I got there in 94,
yeah.
And I felt like there was a great opportunity. It was when South Beach really started to pop, and there was a lot of sizzle and glitz and glamour, and you know, but there wasn't a lot of substance. And some people might say there's still not a lot of substance,
which I
disagree with. But at that time, it was all about the flash and trend and club, and I felt like there was a niche to be filled and an opportunity to make a difference in a town that, you know, in a lot of ways, some deservedly and some not, in a lot of ways got a bad rap.
Well, I mean, we have to sort of look at the time, right? Miami outside of the country, you know, outside of Miami itself, South Florida, you know, was Miami Vice. It was exactly what you suggested. It was clubs, it was glitz, it was drugs, it was all of that stuff. But you did something, and I do want to focus on what you did there. You made a decision to kind of walk away from that and to do something that really was much more Brooklyn, much more sort of, you know, urban than a beach restaurant. Why?
You're talking about when I left and started Michael's January.
I am.
Okay, so it's interesting because this show is about business, right?
It is about business.
The biggest, dumbest business decision ever, you know, was to walk away from a successful business, several businesses with, you know, my then business partner, you know, and basically making an emotional, non-business decision and not having a plan to move forward. So, you know, on one hand, it all turned out great. I could say it was a brilliant decision.
So kids, get your notebooks out, because now you're going to get the good stuff.
Well, because it's true. You know, so I made an emotional decision, didn't have a plan, didn't have a path, just thought that it would happen. You know, and it took a while, and I struggled in that time to really find a niche.
But the emotional decision, I mean, here's what, to me, what's interesting. I'm sure the decision to leave a partnership and walk out on your own. I mean, we, you know, those of us who are entrepreneurs, we, you know, that's always a difficult day, but it's a day that's, you know, it's exciting and it's nerve wracking and it causes you to lose sleep. But the menu you put out, and this is the only time we'll really talk about the food, the menu you put out at Michael's Genuine was as far from Miami-ish as you could get.
Can I just totally change the subject for 2 seconds?
It's your show, babe.
You sure? Because my family's listening, and I don't think that they're gonna, I don't think they're gonna put up with this for a half an hour because this is boring to them. But I just want to say hi to them. So they're here in my, you know, in New York City for the month of July, and they're listening right now. My beautiful wife Tamara,
and she is beautiful,
and my hello, beautiful Tamara. Children Ella, Lulu, and Harry. So the girls are studying at the School of Visual Arts for a couple weeks. Harry's at the School of Rock. He's a badass drummer. So I just want to say hi to you guys. I love you guys. You can turn it off now if you want.
No, well, you know, you can either turn it off or you can listen to your father get pretty smart, because I know you don't have these conversations at home every day. He's usually yelling at you or telling you what else,
yeah,
what else
I
you
do,
should be doing.
All I do at home is talk about business to them. Now listen, you kids, don't make the mistakes that I made. Well, all right, so back to the question about the
make
menu
a few,
at Michael's Genuine. You know, I guess in a way I've been lucky in my career to say, you know, that I could say now that I've always been able to cook things that I like and that people like them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's what Michael's Genuine, when we opened, now we're almost 8 years, was a very personal restaurant, still is.
Yeah.
Has my name on it. And it was really about things that I wanted to eat in a way that I wanted to eat. So, you
know. But it was very, very non-Miami. I mean, I went down there, I met you sort of visiting the restaurant with a couple of friends, having no idea what to expect. And I walked in and I said, this is the last thing I would expect from a Miami restaurateur. But it literally changed the way a lot of the country and a lot of your local clientele viewed the restaurant business in Miami, didn't it?
Well, I think it was the way people viewed dining in this country.
Yeah.
At that time. And what I mean by that, is that it was a time when the rules changed. And I think that people felt like they didn't need white tablecloth and a hush restaurant and a big check and a pretentious waiter to say that they had a fantastic experience with top quality food and great service. So we stripped the tablecloth, we stripped the pretension, you know, we tapped our local farmers, and we made food that we really cared about and were proud of, you know, and so it was a time then that was shifting. And I think that that's really taken hold, maybe to a fault in this country, you know, to a point where
I think the concept of farm to table is probably sounds trite now because it's expected and it should be expected. But when you opened, I do remember having a conversation with you back then. That you were one of the people who said, local, it's not about local, it's about seasonality. And my season and your season are different. So if my season, you know, if I can get kumquats, you know, from a great farmer here now, I can get them up to you in New York. But seasonality was really what you were about. And you were also about, forgive me, you weren't afraid to put food on the damn table.
Right.
You know, it wasn't about the lightest fish, the flakiest fish. It wasn't about that. It was about food.
Well, it was about form too.
Yeah.
You know, tomato's a tomato. So don't screw it up. Just slice it, put some salt on it and great olive oil and say, this is what you should eat. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was never afraid to do that. You know, so, and I think one other interesting thing about Miami is, like you said, the seasons are upside down.
Right.
And it took me a long time to sort of grasp that and to really embrace what Miami had to offer, which is a lot.
Yeah.
You know, so the fish, great. I mean, hands down, one of the best, you know, selections of fresh fish, I think, in the country, if not the world. But also the tropicals. And it was interesting because I wanted to adapt and embrace those ingredients without cooking in that style. I didn't want to be a Caribbean, Floridian. You know, I'm not Norman Van Aken, love that guy, or Alan Susser. you know, I wanted to interpret those ingredients in a different way. So it took a while, and we embraced the local food. We, you know, we celebrated it. We supported local farmers, and I think that that really took hold, not only in Miami, obviously, yeah, but in the whole country.
So I want to turn this on its head and bring this back to a business. We've indulged your chef side for a moment, all right? But what you really turned around was a whole section of Miami. I mean, you took your dumbass idea, as you suggested, your naive, dumbass, emotional decision. You took it to the only part of town where you could afford the rent, the design district of Miami, 8-9 years ago. Could you afford to do that in the design district today?
Yeah, well, that's a great one.
Well, it's important.
Well,
look,
no.
We talk, you know, about this here. Restaurateurs are neighborhood makers.
Right.
And that neighborhood now is one of the most sought-after neighborhoods in the country.
This is true. And so while
I
would like to take some credit, a little bit, I can't take all the credit. And so there's no way in hell that I could say 8 years ago that I saw that coming and, you know, how brilliant of a business decision was that.
No, because...
So no. The truth is that it was affordable rent. There were other places that were cheaper. But it was a neighborhood that I felt like it was an extension to the beach. It was close, and it was accessible from other parts of Miami. And the person that invested mostly in that neighborhood spent some money on the streets, and the streets were nice, and it was a little edgy, but, you know, interesting. And that's why I did it. So, you know, fast forward 8 years, and now my neighbors are Rolex and Cartier and Louis Vuitton and Prada.
And I notice you're not wearing any of their stuff.
Nothing. No. No. I'm wearing flip-flops and, you know.
Well, the you I'm talking about is Michael Schwartz. I'm talking about Michael Schwartz, chef, owner of Michael's Genuine in Miami. Also, one of the coolest places you'll ever find, the Cypress Room in Miami. One of the more fun joints you'll ever find, Harry's Pizza, named after his drummer's son, Harry. Harry, I hope you play there on Tuesdays and Wednesdays each week. If you don't, we can talk about that. We're going to take a short break here on the Business of the Business. Going to let Michael get a glass of water, ask him what else is on his mind, and we're going to come back and educate you a little bit more about Miami and let the Punch Brothers take you away. Talk to you in a minute.
Since 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods guaranteed to produce the very best-tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Red Wattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
All right, we are back on the Business of the Business with my guest, Michael Schwartz.
Business.
The business of the business. See, I try not to do that. It's too easy, and I try to maintain a bit of professionalism in here.
Wow.
A little hard to do while you're sitting here with your feet up.
And,
But certainly, clearly, Michael Schwartz enjoying discussing the olden days of 8 years ago. About walking out of a successful partnership because his vision and the vision of his partners were different, taking a shot in a different area of a city that was underappreciated for its both its culinary base and the farmers who supplied it. We talked about how the neighborhood that Michael's Genuine is in just has exploded over the past few years. But what's also exploded are the opportunities that get provided to highly regarded chefs who can show that they can operate more than one thing at a time. And I think a while back, Mike, we talked about when those first opportunities began to come your way, and you certainly wouldn't jump at anything that was offered. It was sort of, leave me alone. I'm doing what I like doing. Don't come in here and tempt me with things, because I don't know if you're half as committed as I am to what I'm doing. And that's really when we began our business dialogues, is when those types of things would happen. And I want to talk about a couple of them. But when we began the show, I talked about diversification and the diversification of businesses and business portfolios and business ideas. I mean, you took your somewhat of a highbrow reputation in South Florida. Well, you can acknowledge that you were the voice of South Florida restaurants that were operating at a high level. The cruise ship industry is hugely important to the economy of Miami and South Florida. It would not be the first instinct of a hoity-toity New York City chef to say, "Hey, sure, let's talk about putting one of my restaurants on your cruise ship." But you kind of stayed in your neighborhood and were able to do that as part of sort of a neighborhood experience, weren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, talk about it.
Two things. Well, you know the whole strike while the iron's hot thing?
I heard of it.
Usually if the iron's hot, like, you're busy keeping the iron hot.
Yeah, the iron doesn't, the iron doesn't get hot until somebody turns it on.
Right, and it doesn't cool off unless you screw it up. So, so what I tell, because, we're in the instant gratification society, right? And 1-2 years in, opportunities start rolling in.
Yep.
And usually that's not a good time to take advantage of those opportunities. So we waited, and I think that we calculated our growth, and we there was lots of opportunities, thankfully. And one of them was with Royal Caribbean, who, frankly, is an unlikely partner.
Yeah.
An unlikely partnership.
So. Right.
So I'll tell you a little bit about why it made sense for us. The opportunity came for us to do on the biggest ship in the world, the Oasis of the Seas, with Royal Caribbean, sails out of Fort Lauderdale, Port Everglades. The opportunity was to do the menu for the fine dining restaurant on board the ship. It's called 150 Central Park.
Now, that wasn't your dream.
No, none of this. Listen,
and of course, 150 Central Park, of course, conjures up the ocean in my mind.
Well, let me tell you why.
It doesn't.
Well, you know what? It doesn't.
Right.
But what people don't know is that on the Oasis of the Seas, there's a park that's open air that's called Central Park. And it's pretty outstanding. So, biggest cruise ship in the world, 6,000 passengers, 2,000 crew. It's an amazing ship. And so when we got to know it a little bit, the opportunity was to do the menu for this fine dining restaurant. 6-course tasting menu, wine pairings. Great. How does that connect with Michael's Genuine and our brand? It's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, more importantly, how does that connect with Michael Schwartz?
Well, I'm going to tell you.
All right.
Thanks for asking.
It's what I do. It's what
and
I
it's
do.
A beautifully appointed restaurant. It's beautiful. The hook for us was that, okay, we'll do that if we could provision the ship every week with product from our favorite farmers in South Florida. And that was the hook. And they bit. So this was our opportunity, small as it might be, one ship, one restaurant, to influence the supply chain on a cruise ship.
Which is next to impossible.
Pretty much. but kudos A to Royal Caribbean for entertaining the idea.
Right.
And supporting it. So that's what we did. So that's, so anyone that could say to me, hey, how do you partner with a company like Royal Caribbean? A, I could say it's a great company, and they're doing stuff on the ship with food and beverage that you would not know or realize unless you sort of went behind the scenes or you enjoyed one of their cruises.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the food on cruise ships is generally getting better. But I'm not here to defend the cruise ship.
No. This is part of our discussion. This is the diversity of your business, right?
Exactly. Right. But I often have to because people say, how could you partner with a company like Royal Caribbean? So not only were my farmers thrilled to death at this possibility, but, you know, it was an opportunity for us in a small way to influence the supply chain. So here's what we did. So the menu changed every 4 months. We keyed in on two or three farmers that provisioned the ship every week. We created these wine pairings and with our wine director, Eric Larkey, who you know.
Yeah, Eric. And how did you get the stuff there? I mean, if you're out on the ocean, talk to me.
Because
about
every
it.
Week, so it's a 7-day cruise,
mm-hmm.
and it's like Groundhog Day. So the ship goes out, it comes back, everything goes off, all new provisions go on, and they set sail. And it's an amazing choreographed dance that is really remarkably spectacular. That's mm-hmm. all I could say. And so until you've experienced that behind the scenes of them provisioning and what goes on in the lower decks of the ship, you would never know. But we were thrilled. And our farmers were thrilled. And the guests really dug it. So it was a chance for us to do fancy food. But in a more approachable way, we used the cookbook and featured a lot of recipes on the cookbook. It was a huge success.
The cookbook. What's the name of the cookbook?
Michael's Genuine Food. Down to earth cooking for people that love to eat.
Still
something
out
like
there.
That.
That's
yeah,
right.
It's still out there.
Still out there. Still selling.
Yeah. Third printing.
Whoa.
So it was such a success that they invited us on the sister ship, the Allure of the Seas. So now we're on two ships. So we're sort of, you know, making our little progress on this farm to ship thing.
And do you still like doing it?
Yeah. I'm not crazy about being on the ship, but I love the work that we're doing. I think people appreciate it. It's different. The farmers love it. I think it's introducing people that normally wouldn't be exposed to something like that to farm to table.
Isn't that what it's really all about?
Right.
That's exactly.
Okay. So fast forward to now. In working with Royal Caribbean, and this was a great example of an organic relationship that grew over a period of time because we dipped our toe in the water with them and we liked it, you know. And so then we did the second ship. Now we have an opportunity. We're doing a Michael's Genuine Pub, branded gastropub on board their new class of ships, Quantum of the Seas. First ship.
How
sails,
big are they?
4,000 passengers. A little bit smaller, a little bit more intimate. The first ship sails.
Mike, 4,000 is not intimate.
It's a little more intimate.
All right, come on. I'm not going to just let you roll over me here.
Listen, the first ship sails this fall out of New York.
Nueva York.
So it'll be three ships. We're super excited. It's a Michael's Genuine pub, snack menu, craft cocktails, craft beer, including Michael's Genuine homebrew.
That's
a very small focus wine list. The first ship sails. The first ship sails this fall. Then the ship will move to China. Second ship will come to New York. Third ship's going to sail out of Southampton, UK. So an amazing, amazing opportunity that sort of grew organically from this little relationship that we started. And then Oasis is launching Oasis 2. So we'll be on six ships within the next 3 years.
So what was the day like when you got approached on that? And did you really feel like this was going to even remotely have the impact that it's had?
No, because it built. It wasn't like, hey, do you want to be on six cruise ships, three of which will have your logo and name on the ship?
Which
it wasn't like that.
Which is when I talk, you know, when I'm working with chefs of a certain name, that's often what's offered, right? Is this idea that hey, come in and pollinate one of our spaces,
right? Well, I'm not that big of a deal, like
big deal.
The people that you're referring to that will remain nameless.
But so
it was sort of presented in this way over a period of time. So it wasn't like this aha moment where it was like, yes, here's an opportunity to be on six ships. It happened over a long period of time. So
how many of the people that are on those ships and in those kitchens that you are describing are your employees?
Zero.
Okay. How do you train them?
Yeah.
How do you train somebody else's employees?
Well, very carefully. But those people are fantastic, and you show them once and they do it. So when we first went on the ship, we put a chef on the ship, and he worked with the team, and he was our guy. He became a Royal Caribbean employee, but he was our guy. But since then, sort of the culture sets in, and we go and check periodically, and they're very good to work with. So
So your idea here, I mean, one of the always the concerns with you and with your colleagues are, wow, if I just license my sort of intellectual property and my methodology, you know, people aren't gonna embrace it that are preparing it. How is it that you have taken that mantle and sort of made it your own? How do you get them to embrace your style?
Little by little.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, for the new ships, the Michael's Genuine Pub, we're going to peg one guy. He'll be a lead, bar server in the pub. Mm-hmm. He's been working at Michael's Genuine for a couple years. Our whole team will go on initially and culture train and then follow up and keep our fingers crossed.
So one of the things that always scratches my head, because you know I'm working in that industry too.
Right, but let me go back and say this, because I don't want to lose this thought. What was key in this relationship was the comfort level over a period of time. So we know now the people that we're working with. We've been working with them for 3 years now.
Just trust.
So that comfort level allows us to say we could do this much. Mm-hmm. And not bite off more than we could chew, but there is a comfort level. So I'm sorry for interrupting.
Yeah, no, it's your show, man. That's why I wanted you here. Listen, not enough of your colleagues, I think, are as excited to share about the details like that. I think a lot of people like to keep them close to the vest, sort of pretend there's a mystery that doesn't exist. No, the mystery's not there.
Sharing,
at least in this, right. And you're talking about, again, you know, you're talking about four or five different economies that are being impacted. You know, you've got the cruise ship economy, you've got the farming economy, you've got the tourism economy, you've got, you've got the restaurant. You know, people are recognizing your restaurants more if they're on those ships. Does that mean that Michael's Genuine grows more? You've resisted putting a Michael's Genuine anywhere else that isn't a stone's throw from where you are.
Yeah. So what's the question?
Are more Michael's Genuine going to be put out there, or is it more evolution of Michael Schwartz's business ideas?
You know, I have no idea how to answer that question because, you know, really, if you would have asked me when I opened Michael's Genuine, if I would open another
one.
I did ask you, and
you said no.
Exactly. Exactly. But then we did. You know, so, you know, I'm not sure. You know, we don't have a blueprint for growth. We take opportunities and analyze them as they come, and we look at timing and our infrastructure and make sure that we're not biting off more than we could chew. You know, it's easy to make a deal, you know, and so,
yes,
and you
is.
Know this. Mm-hmm. And then you could get deal, you know, happy. You know, it's easy to make the deal, but then you got to execute and operate. So that's what we're trying to be careful about. You know, of not biting off more than we could chew. And I like the fact that we're sort of diversified in restaurants that we own and operate. And then there's a good section of management licensing agreements, some consulting. I like that, mixing that up like that.
Michael, now you're talking my language. We're talking the business of the business now. And here's what I'm going to ask you. I'm going to ask you a huge favor.
Mm-hmm.
All right? We're going to wrap up today's 30 minutes because I don't want to overstimulate the audience. All right, right now.
They're going nuts.
They're going crazy. They're writing all this stuff.
Frenzied.
Down. Exactly. What I'm going to ask you to do, I'm going to ask you to go home, think more about this, come back next week at 5:00, and let's talk about how the hotel industry has impacted the business for you, how it's impacted the business for others, and how it is that you have to fight the urge to bite off more than you can chew.
Sounds good.
Sounds good?
Yeah.
All right.
Let's do it.
Mr. Inslee, Professor Inslee, he's giving me the thumbs up. Michael Schwartz of Michael's Genuine in Miami, of the Cypress Room in Miami, of Harry's in Miami, of a number of other Miami iconic locations that you'll hear about next week. Thanks for joining us today, Michael. Thanks for coming all the way to Bushwick.
Thanks, Phil. It's been a great pleasure.
We're going to have more fun next week.
Yay, fun.
All right.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network.
You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.